Mac Geeks. It is Friday, February 11th, 2005. This is your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geek. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. Well, Apple has released its latest update for OS X Panther. Version 10.3.8 is available via software update. The key enhancements include improved OpenGL technology and updated ATI and NVIDIA graphics drivers, improved file sharing and directory services, specifically for mixed Mac and PC networks, improved compatibility for third-party applications and devices, and the update includes all the previous security updates for OS 10.3. Today, Apple's board of directors approved a 2-for-1 split of Apple stock. That means the currently 900 million available shares is going to be increased to 1.8 billion. The stock split should happen at the close of business on February 18th, and Apple's stock is currently priced out at 81.21, which, guys, this is that's just a crazy price for Apple stock. So they definitely need the split to get that per share price down. You know, in my opinion, Apple's per share price shouldn't be at this point over 50. I know the iPod has really driven the stock price up, but I mean, come on, $81. That's a little high even for Apple. You know, I love to see them doing well, but let's not get, you know, back to crazy .com pricing. You know, when Apple was up at 150, and you know that was a evaluation that was just way too high. All right, next I want to tell you about a great piece of software that I just came across or saw released, something I had been waiting for being a podcaster for a really long time. It's a new piece of software called Feeder. It's from a company called Reinvented Software. There's a link in the show notes directly to the website, but it's reinventedsoftware.com. The application retails for $24.95, and basically it creates, edits, and publishes RSS feeds, which I had been doing mine manually using BBEdit, actually hand typing out the XML for my RSS feed. And it has full support for enclosures, so it's absolutely fabulous for podcasting. I downloaded it, I'm on the 15-day trial, and I can tell you almost with 100% certainty I'm going to buy it because it's saving me a lot of time in getting this podcast out. Has a great graphics user interface. It's kind of reminiscent, I think, of NetNewsWire, if you've ever used that product, which is a newsreader. And it has the three-paned approach, so you have all of your RSS feeds on the left-hand side and simple forms for filling out all the information you need to put into your feed file. And it will actually publish your RSS feed directly to your FTP site if you configure it that way. And it has a nice little preview window so you can see what your feed's going to look like when it gets picked up by the aggregators. So really great product. Something us podcasters had been waiting for, at least the ones running OS X and using Macs. Okay, next I wanted to talk about an issue that some of you, especially the ones using a Windows program for picking up this podcast called Doppler, podcatching client Doppler, had been experiencing with my feed. I got some emails on this, and Adam Curry has also mentioned it on his show. I guess it's related to, or the problem is that people on Doppler are suddenly, as of last week, I believe, not able to receive, or Doppler's not picking up the new feed updates, the new shows that are being published. And Adam Curry had done some looking into this. I kind of did some poking around, and turns out that .mac apparently will not send back the file size information on the MP3 file that's getting downloaded. And Doppler wants to use this because it's one of the few podcatching clients that has resumable downloads. So if your download was interrupted while you were trying to grab it, it could actually pick back up. And of course it needs to know how big the file is so that it can compare how much it got versus how much it still needs to pick up. And apparently Apple changed something with .mac accounts, and they no longer support the header request that needs to get sent out, and they actually send back a error message. It's a 403 invalid method error. And apparently this also affects, and I had another listener send me an email on this, the Firefox web browser, when you try and right-click on an MP3 file, say on maccast.com, and do a save as. Firefox actually won't let you do the save as. It's grayed out. And apparently this also has to do with this header request to .mac. So I'm not really sure what we're going to do about that. There's really no fix at the moment. Hopefully we get enough people to email Apple and the .mac people and tell them to fix it, tell them to support this header request. But until then, if you're using Doppler, please try out one of the other podcatching clients or just go directly to the website and download your MP3 files in the interim. And I apologize for the inconvenience on that, but I really don't have a workaround. And as soon as I do, I will let everyone know. So I am getting more and more great feedback every day from you all, and I really appreciate it, so keep it coming. You can contact me, mattcast@gmail.com. You can send either text emails or MP3 audio comments, and you can also call the MattCast hotline, 206-222-2788, 20-MATCAST-8. But anyway, we got some feedback from listener Eric, and he had a question for us.
Hi, Adam. Name's Eric. Fan of the show, but I wanted to get your opinion on something, your thoughts. Thinking about getting a Mac Mini. I'm currently not a Mac user. I got an iPod Shuffle, but I'm wanting to. The Mac Mini interested me, being small and relatively inexpensive. Want to know what you thought about the 1.2 versus the 1.4 and change gigahertz processor that's out there for it. Is the faster processor really worth the extra money? That's probably my main question for you. And another question I had too was, what do you think about, you know, the possibility of waiting for Panther to come out before I would get it? Is Panther a big enough an upgrade to even worry about that? Are there enough features there where it would make it worthwhile to wait for Panther to come out? Thanks. Look forward to hearing on the show.
So those are a couple of great questions that Eric has. Is the 1.42 gigahertz Mac Mini worth the extra $100 to get that processor over the 1.25? And I can honestly say it probably depends on what you're going to be using it for. You know, if you're just doing office stuff and surfing the internet and things like that, then it's probably not going to benefit you that much more to have the 1.42 over the 1.25. If you're going to be doing a lot more video work, maybe using iMovie, encoding a lot of MP3 files and things like that, yeah, you might see a slight improvement. But again, I mean, there's not much difference between 1.25 and 1.42. So, you know, personally, if I was looking at it, I would think I would want to save the $100 and spend that elsewhere, maybe on more RAM, which is going to benefit you much more, I think, than the faster processor. But more than the bigger processor, the better upgrade or the more beneficial upgrade in the 1.42 is probably the 80 gigabyte hard drive over the 40 gigabyte hard drive. You essentially double your storage space. So if you're not the type of person that is going to want to crack open the case on the Mac Mini, if you have to upgrade your hard drive, you may consider doing the 1.42 just to get the larger hard disk, especially, again, if you're going to be doing video editing or a lot of MP3 music files or something like that. You're going to find, I think, pretty quick that you're going to want that extra storage. You know, if anybody out in the listening audience has a differing opinion on that, let us know so we can let Eric make the most informed decision he possibly can. On the other question, I get that one a lot, actually. Should I wait for OS X Tiger before I actually go make the leap and buy a Macintosh? And again, you know, that kind of comes up to what you're comfortable with. Panther is an awesome operating system. I don't think Tiger is going to have that many more improvements to say that when Tiger comes out, you're going to need to dump Panther and upgrade to Tiger. I think what is actually going to be true is you're just going to want to upgrade to Tiger. So if you want to hold off and don't want to buy a Macintosh till, you know, sometime mid-summer, which is when I would assume Tiger is going to be coming out,
then that's fine. You might even benefit from, you know, newer models or prices dropping by then. If you want to get into a Mac now and start doing some really great stuff and join this community we got going, I would just buy it now. And, you know, when Tiger comes out, it's only going to be a $99 upgrade. So it's not much to spend for the next version of the operating system. And I would say if you were happy with Panther, you don't absolutely have to upgrade to Tiger. It's going to have some great features and I'm going to upgrade, but you know, to each his own on that. So, you know, that's kind of my opinion. Anybody else weigh in with what they want by sending a comment to the MacCast.
So the next couple questions I have to do with podcasting, and the first one is a question about podcasting call-in hotlines like the MacCast hotline.
Hey, it's a listener of the MacCast with a quick question. You said that you didn't have any people leaving voice messages, so I wanted to try it. And this is sort of not related specifically to Mac, although I've got to say I have an iMac, and I've got a PowerBook, and I've got an iPod. And my brother's got an iBook and a 23-inch Apple Cinema display and an iSight and iPod Photo, and you know, we're Mac geeks at heart. Although I have PCs at home, I have Mac hardware to work. Why are all the podcast voicemail numbers starting with 206? I noticed Don and Drew Show has it. You know. Some Godcasts have it, the Technorati tag podcast. I mean, what is going on with this? Is there some kind of free voicemail thing that everyone's missing out on, or do you all live in Seattle or what? I know that the Don and Drew Show has it, but they're not in Seattle. They're in Wisconsin. So somebody, please explain this, and you know what? I decided to call you first. So anyways, give us the scoop on your show. Thanks very much. Keep rocking.
Okay, so what's the scoop, eh? Well, I can tell you right up front, we don't all live in Seattle. That's very much true. I actually podcast from San Diego. So we're not all living in Seattle. The reason behind the 206 number is actually that there is a free voicemail service that you can sign up for. It's at k7.net. It's a free voicemail account, and basically they're a company in Seattle, so they have all Seattle numbers. And the main reason I think most podcasters choose K7.net is, one, a couple reasons. You can record a voicemail, and it'll be emailed, the audio file will be emailed to whatever email account you want. So when you leave a message there, I actually get a email at the MacCast@gmail.com account with a little WAV file in it, and that's how I get your comments on the show. And then the other reason that we choose it is that you can, the K7 service, as opposed to something like J2.net, which is the one owned by Yahoo, is K7 will let you search their database of numbers for a vanity number. So that's why I was able to have 20 MacCast 8 as my telephone number. I just did a search on MacCast and it kicked back a bunch of phone numbers with MacCast, the word MacCast in them. So that's why. No huge conspiracy of all podcasters hailing from Seattle. Okay, and the other question was from Dan. He was wondering a little bit about podcasting stats.
Hi, Adam. My name is Dan Wagner, and actually your show is the very first podcast I've ever heard, and I just thought I'd try to send you a message here. I had a question. Are there any programs out there that will help you to monitor the metrics of your podcast? Now, I realize on your website you can tell how many downloads there have been and also how many people are subscribing to your feed, but my question is more on the base of, you know, TiVo gets stats on which programs people watch, obviously, and how much of the program they're watching. And I was wondering if that exists for podcasts yet. So can you tell... anyway, how long people are listening to your show? Are they playing any parts of your program back over and over again? And when are they tuning out? I think it'd be kind of interesting to find out metrics like this. So if there's anything out there, I'd appreciate a message. Let me know that it exists because I'd like to look into that too. Thanks a lot, and good job on your show. I like it.
Well, Dan, this is going to be a very quick answer, and the answer is no. There is actually nothing like that at all. I know what you're talking about on the TiVo service. And the TiVo stats are really cool. It'd be interesting to have eyes into all the data that they collect, but no, there's absolutely nothing like that for podcasting at all. About the closest thing, like you noticed, is FeedBurner. FeedBurner.com provides a new service that lets you track basically how many people are subscribed in a given day to your podcast, to your RSS feed. And we can get those stats. And besides that, you just have your regular stats you'd get with any other web server. So how many people visited your page, how many people accessed the MP3 download files, things like that. But hey, if you are a developer and you're considering making that type of application or trying to tackle that that problem, I'd love to see a solution for that. It would be really great if podcasting could have stats like that, especially as we're trying to figure out how to maybe make a little money off this and attract advertisers and things like that. Okay, now I want to rant a little bit, or not so much rant, but just comment on something. And I've heard this now come up a couple times. Came up on Adam Curry's show, and came up on Todd Cochran's Geek News Central podcast just today. And Todd had just gotten a new Mac Mini, or he's a PC user, and he's checking out the Mac Mini for actually doing his podcast. He's I don't know if he's necessarily making a switch, but at least he's taking a look at some Apple hardware, and he's trying to be objective about it. And apparently some people were harassing him because he says OS X instead of OS 10 when commenting or when talking about the Apple operating system. And Adam Curry had the same problem. Adam Curry says OS X instead of OS 10. And in Adam Curry's view on it is that OS X is just a sexier term. It sounds sexier than OS 10. And I kind of agree with him. And, you know, apparently some hardcore Mac people were giving Todd a hard time for using OS X. And Todd's gone so far as to change how he says the name of the operating system to saying OS 10. You know, I think OS X is sexier. I, you know, interchange the two of them, and I think both are perfectly fine. So, you know, back off, you guys. Let's just welcome these new switchers to the Mac community, and let's not give them a hard time over the semantics of what you call the operating system. Oh, it's OS 10, not OS X, you silly PC user. You know, hey, cut it out. All right, last thing for tonight is I got an email from David, and he brought up another question that I get a lot from new Mac users, or even long-term Mac users, when they're looking at upgrading their systems. And what he wanted to know is, in terms of RAM, is it better to buy RAM for a new machine directly from Apple or from a third party? And with higher RAM capacities, is there need for more testing of RAM when you're buying it? And on the second question, I don't really know about testing of RAM, or if you need. I think he was specifically asking about when you start trying to max out a G5 tower with 8 gigabytes of RAM. You have all that RAM in there. Do you need more? Higher quality RAM, does it need to be run through more tests? That I don't know. As you get into the larger sticks, I have no idea. If anybody does know what the deal on RAM when you start doing large, you know, like 1 gigabyte, 2 gigabyte RAM, you know, sticks of RAM, does it require more testing? And you know what? Are there even 2 gigabyte sticks of RAM? I might not know what I'm talking about. That question I don't know about. But what I do know about RAM, and this is just my personal experience in terms of buying it, if you buy it from Apple, you're going to pay more. The one thing there is that you're basically insured of the quality that it's going to work with your system, and you're not going to have any issues with it. Personally, I don't buy my RAM from Apple. I think it's overpriced. But I do buy high quality RAM, and I have always only ever bought Kingston or Viking brand RAM for my machines, and I have never had a problem with bad RAM. Now, I have other friends who swear that you can buy, you know, El Cheapo, Bob's House of RAM, RAM chips, and they'll run just fine in your Mac. And, you know, technically that's true. I will say that in my personal experience, a large percentage of the people I know who buy that type of RAM, that dirt cheap RAM, sometimes end up having issues with it down the road. And they have RAM issues on their systems. And issues with RAM are incredibly hard to diagnose. When you start having problems with your system, it's really hard to track down a RAM problem. So, you know, I just say save yourself the hassle up front. Spend a little bit more money on a brand name RAM. And I know another place I've never purchased from here specifically for myself, so I can't speak from personal experience, but a number of people I know buy their RAM from Crucial.com and are very, very happy with that RAM. So that's supposed to be very high quality RAM for your system. So you can try that. I would stay away from the El Cheapo RAM, but hey, if you want to save some bucks and take your chances, you know, some people end up getting good quality RAM at very low, or RAM that does very well for them at low quality price, at low prices. So, you know, that's my opinion. All right, that's the show for tonight. I want to talk to you about a couple things I'm going to be doing different just for tonight. I don't have any new music for you just because I haven't received any. So if you are a listener and you have a band and you want to get your music played on the MacCast, send your tracks to maccast@gmail.com, your MP3 files, and we'll get you on the show. But the other reason I decided not to just pick up a piece of music and play it for you or play a track we've already played before is I got a great report. We've been talking a lot about running Linux on your Macintosh, specifically Yellow Dog Linux, and I got a great report from a listener, Michael, and he explains just about everything you want to know about Yellow Dog Linux on the Mac or running Linux on your Macintosh. And it's a great overview, and I think it's worthwhile for those who want to listen to it. It does run a little long. It's about 11 minutes, so I'm putting it at the end of the show so that you can make a choice. If you want to listen to it and find out more about Linux on the Macintosh, go ahead. Otherwise, you can just end the show here, and I will see you next time. The other thing I want to mention is I've received a number of great audio files with switcher stories. We had a listener who was interested in switching and wanted to hear, you know, what the experience was like. And I think I'm going to go ahead and put those together into a separate show, sort of a MacCast special on switching. And we may even make it a regular feature if you guys continue to send in your switcher stories. Every time I get four or five of them, maybe we'll assemble them together into a little mini switcher show. So I'm going to do one up. I'll probably try and put it out sometime over the weekend. And I'll put those out in between MacCasts, and I'll tag them so you guys will know what they are when they hit your iPodders. But be looking for that. With that, I'm going to leave you guys. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you all next time.
Hello, MacCast. This is Michael from Illinois. Today I wanted to answer a listener question from Joe, who asks about using Linux on Macintosh hardware. I want to cover the following topics. 1. Do any companies currently use Linux on Mac hardware? And if so, why did they choose that configuration? 2. Which Linux distributions are available for the Mac platform? I have a lot of experience with Yellow Dog Linux, and so I will briefly talk about that. 3. Why I chose to install Linux on my Mac, and what installation and day-to-day usage is like. And to conclude, I'll try to make some recommendations in case anyone is interested in experimenting with Linux on their own Mac. Let's start with our first topic, who uses Linux on Mac hardware and why? The list is actually pretty extensive. It ranges from government organizations like NASA and the US Navy, to companies like Boeing, Lockheed, 3M, Adidas, America Online, HBO, IBM, Polaroid, Walt Disney, and many others. The list also includes a multitude of colleges and universities, like Harvard, Carnegie Mellon, Johns Hopkins, Yale, MIT, Stanford, Berkeley, UCLA, and many more. Why would such organizations choose to run Linux on Mac hardware? It seems that many have recently purchased Xservs, especially the HPC version. Others comment favorably about the G5 or AltaVec, which is Apple's term for SIMD, or Single Instruction Multiple Data. In the education realm, my guess is that many schools had stockpiles of older Macs from old computer labs that don't run OS X very well or not at all, and they were able to give these machines a new lease on life with Linux. I know that many home users install Linux on very old Macs that won't run anything else, and are then able to use them just fine as little servers around the house. Let's go on to our next topic, which covers the various Linux distributions that are available for the Mac platform. Most of the major x86 distributions also have PowerPC ports. These are Debian, Gentoo, SUSE, Mandrake, and Yellowdog, which is based on Red Hat. There are many other lesser-known distributions, but I won't mention these because they all seem to be based on one of the better-known ones, like Debian, for example. In my case, I had a lot of experience with Red Hat, and even various offshoots like Whitebox, so I decided to go with Yellowdog Linux. At the time, it was version 3.0, though Adam recently mentioned that they have now released version 4.0. Yellowdog Linux is based on Red Hat's Fedora and the RPM Package Manager. The current version comes with the 2.6.10 kernel, KDE 3.3, and GNOME 2.6, and any Red Hat user will instantly recognize the great Anaconda installer. The four installation CDs also contain a lot of other software, like OpenOffice, Mozilla, GCC, and basically anything you'd find on a typical Linux distribution. I'll take a second to mention that one very nice aspect of dealing with Mac hardware, even on Linux, is that, like Adam mentioned, you're not dealing with a million possible hardware configurations, like weird PCI and AGP cards and the like. The hardware is pretty much locked down. What I mean by that is that if I'm using an iBook, there are only so many possible hardware configurations for that iBook. The Linux developers know this and are able to have most things working out of the box, like onboard sound, video, modems and Ethernet, thermal fans, USB and FireWire, and so forth. While it's not completely glitch-free and it isn't at all at the level of OS X, it's far beyond the level of problems that Linux users typically have with PC laptops. I suspect that this may be a reason why so many companies are using Linux on the Mac platform. They need Linux for whatever reason and don't have a choice about that, but they still prefer to have Mac hardware. Let's move on to point number 3, which is installation and user experience. This is a very large topic that may need to wait for another date for a more in-depth discussion if there is interest. But let me just mention as briefly as possible that you need to take the following steps to install Linux on your Mac. If you want to completely erase the hard drive and the current operating system, then you don't need to do much more than to boot from the Linux installation CD and specify during the installation that you want it to take over the entire hard drive, erasing all current data. However, if you want Linux and OS X to coexist and be able to boot into either one when you start the computer, the process is more complicated. First, you need to partition the hard drive to make room for a Linux installation. I've looked around, but I don't believe there is an OS X equivalent to Partition Magic, which is a great Windows program that lets you manage your hard drives and work with partitions. Some people recommend the command line pdisk utility, but I wasn't aware of that at the time and went with the more common method of using Apple's disk utility tool to split my hard drive into two partitions. Unfortunately, this messes up your existing OS X installation and effectively deletes it, so you'll have to back up all your data beforehand and reinstall OS X on one of the partitions you just created. After that is done, you install Linux and make sure to do a manual hard drive configuration so that you can point it at the other partition and set up the bootloader properly. That's all I want to say about installation, but let me also say that if you want to reclaim that hard drive space and uninstall Linux, I'm not aware of any way of doing that without going through the same partitioning process and having to completely reinstall OS X yet again. However, from Linux you can have full access to your OS X file system using the kernel module HFS Plus, and in OS X you can use the SourceForge utility ext2fsx, that's ext2fsx, to gain full access to your Linux partition. So you can in effect use the free space on your Linux partition as just another hard drive under OS X. Let me briefly mention the user experience of Linux on the Macintosh. If you're familiar with Linux on the PC, there's virtually no difference in day-to-day use. I decided to install it on my iBook G3500 because at the time I was using an early version of Jaguar, and browsing a large web page in the Firefox browser was sluggish, very jumpy and not smooth at all. At that time, installing Yellowdog Linux 3.0 on the same iBook made a huge difference. Internet browsing was completely smooth, again with Firefox. However, once Panther came around and I tried that, I saw that that was also completely smooth, totally on par with my Linux. So at that time, I made the switch to Panther and never looked back. The one constant annoyance that I had during my time with Linux on the Mac was finding pre-compiled Linux binaries for PowerPC. However, everything typically compiles just fine from source code, so you usually just download the source code and then run your configure, make install, and it just works. Let me now share a Linux on Mac experience with you. When iTunes for Windows came out, I wanted to convert my iPod from Mac format to Windows format. However, that process completely erases the iPod, so I wanted to make a backup of my music first. By default, neither Windows nor OS X allow you to copy music from your iPod to the computer. I know there are lots of sites and shareware programs dedicated to doing just that, but I tried a lot of them and nothing ever worked for me. So I rebooted the iBook into Linux, connected the iPod to the FireWire port like usual, and then thanks to the HFS Plus kernel module, which allows you to read Macintosh formatted disks, I was able to mount the iPod as a SCSI drive under Linux. I then FTP'd into the iBook from my PC, went to the folder that corresponded to the iPod disk, and FTP'd all my music from the iPod through the iBook directly into my PC. A lot of Linux distributions advertise that Linux gives you complete control over your computer, and that was one instance where I was truly able to do something in Linux that neither Windows nor OS X allowed me to do, and I thought that was really cool. I'll briefly mention MOL, or Mac on Linux, which is a program that runs on your Macintosh Linux system. While in theory it's an emulator-like virtual PC in that it allows you to run an instance of OS X in your Linux environment, it is actually running the Macintosh operating system on a Macintosh computer, so it does not incur the usual speed penalties that we often see with emulators, and runs at pretty much native speed. However, it's still an emulator, and when I tried it last year, a lot of things didn't work, like sound and internet, so in my experience, it's impractical to use for anything. I also wanted to say something about the user community of Linux on the Macintosh. Because it's a relatively small community of users, a niche within a niche, as they like to say, people are very friendly and it's very easy to get help. For example, Yellow Dog Linux runs an active IRC channels where anyone can talk to the actual lead developers of the operating system, as well as lots of other users, and they are all very friendly and extremely knowledgeable. Overall, that level of support is phenomenal. Let me now move on to my final point, which is to tie all this together and make some recommendations, in case anyone is interested in experimenting with Linux on their own system. First of all, if you're completely inexperienced with Linux, I would strongly recommend that you start out with a PC distribution that is intended for new users. While it's not difficult to get it all running on the Mac if you know what you're doing, you need to be experienced enough with Linux in the first place to be able to tell the difference between you doing something wrong and the system not working correctly, which sometimes happens because new development and bug fixes are happening all the time. And in regards to Joe's comments about TerraSoft Solutions and their Yellow Dog Linux, I myself prefer Red Hat over other distributions, so Yellow Dog was the obvious choice for me. It's also a great starting point because it's got the excellent Red Hat installer, it's based on Fedora, which is cutting edge and has a lot of user momentum right now, and the level of support that's available for Yellow Dog Linux is phenomenal. As far as purchasing a Mac directly from TerraSoft Solutions, I myself don't see a lot of benefit in that. You can download Yellow Dog Linux or any of those distributions for free and burn it to